Hello and welcome to The Magic Word. My name is Scott Wells, and today my guest is Paul Draper. Hello, Paul.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
I'm glad that you are here as well. I always like to have guys who are coming through on a lecture tour to stop by just to chat for a bit because they have so much knowledge to impart to the magic community, which is why they're on the lecture tour. And you're kind of almost finished or more than halfway finished, I guess, in this tour. Is that right?
Right. It's been a big, long tour. I haven't been home for a month, but I'll have four more cities before I go home.
And what is unique about your lecture that you think that you have to give that other people haven't or other lecturers?
Right. I think what I'm bringing to the table here is that I'm a current working pro, that I don't make my living from selling to magicians. Mm-hmm. I don't make my living from selling products to magicians. I make my living performing as a mentalist in Las Vegas, in Hollywood, on television, and I'm bringing practical advice both of how to get booked, how to create a character in a show that allows you to get booked, how to brand yourself, market yourself, and what it is that people in those environments, Vegas, Hollywood, etc., want to buy right now.
Right. And so that makes it a whole lot different than others, as you say, who are actually out there to sell, you know, lecture notes and tricks and gimmicks and decks of cards and lecture notes or whatever.
If an individual has the mindset of my primary goal is to create magic tricks that magicians want to buy, then they're creating a show for magicians. I mean, that is their product.
True.
But my show is very different. Mine is about, so you've moved to Las Vegas, you've moved to Hollywood, or maybe you're living in your own community and you want a new income stream. Mm-hmm. Here are fast ways that you can do it with what you're doing right now without having to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, there are too few who are out on the lecture tour actually talking then about specifically what you do. And one of the things I did like, number one, as you were introducing yourself, because a lot of people don't know you, or if they do, they haven't seen you perform, to introduce not your character, but your performing persona by doing a couple of things to kind of get the lecture started.
That was an idea of Stephen Bergotzi's. He's a great performer out of Nashville, but performs all over the place. He saw me and he said, you know, Paul, you're really famous in on the West Coast, but out here in Nashville and Murfreesboro, nobody knows who you are.
Yeah.
He said, you need to perform the start of your show. He said, the reason that I support what you do and I told all these clubs that they needed to book you was because I saw you perform at Magic in the Rockies, and I loved your comedy and your character and all this. And he said, you have to start your show with your lecture with part of your show. And I said, but I can't give away those tricks because I start my show with effects that belong to other people.
Sure.
He said, well, then just tell them the resources where they can find that,
and move
but
on.
You need to do it.
Yeah.
And so I did.
And so you changed from that point, from Nashville on, the rest of the tour? And
for the rest of the tour.
Kind of adjusted the rudder a little bit.
Absolutely.
You know, trimmed your sail.
Look, every town I've learned something from someone. In every town, there's a guy that's a working pro that's come to the lecture. In every town, there's a guy that's a great collector of magic.
Mm-hmm.
In every town, there's the guy that's been to every convention and seen everybody.
Yeah.
In every town, there are these people who have polished me, who have taught me, who have made me better through the experience of meeting them.
And this is your first lecture tour. You've lectured
ever.
A lot, but never as far as...
Right. I've lectured at the Castle, at Mindvention, at Magic Live, at Magic in the Rockies, but this is the first time I've given a tour, and it's so nice because I gave you a list of 30 cities that I've never been to or haven't been to in over a decade, and you booked so many, 12 cities that I've never been to. And so being able to see the art galleries, the museums, the zoos, the plays, Elvis's house, right? And all of these different places. And now when I am doing a show and I meet someone from each of these cities, I now have a talking point.
Right.
I now have a place where we can connect and I know something about them.
Right. Plus, you have met so many people that you didn't know before, and so you kind of have a network of new friends.
Yes, to make friends all over the world. Magic truly is a brotherhood, a sisterhood, a family of magicians. And once we're in this business for life. And there are only 10 or 20,000 of us on Earth.
Right.
And once we know a couple of 100 magicians, we now know all magicians.
Pretty much.
A step away.
Yeah. It's just... the 7 degrees of separation, you know,
becomes
basically.
Becomes the 2 degrees.
2 degrees, exactly. And now you're going to be also going over to England for a tour of about a dozen cities.
Right. In June, I have 14 cities, I think, right now booked, and very excited about that. I've never been to England before. I've been all over Europe and through the Mediterranean, but never England, oddly enough. And so it's very exciting to be able to have that opportunity.
You're going to love that. It's, they're great mates over there, and you'll find them to be just as hospitable, of course, as people have been for to you throughout the U.S. here as well. Now, you are a mentalist, but what is interesting, again, is that it's not the tricks, it's the presentation. And that's really right. What all mentalism is about, I believe, as Banachek and I have talked in the past. That also, we've had a lot of discussions on magic, mentalism magic or mental magic. Or
right.
You know, and, you know, there can be a fine line as to how you can take a trick and make it so that it becomes more of a mentalist effect as opposed to a magical effect. How do you go about finding things that you do? So it's not a magician, so it is actually something of the mind.
It all has to come from the character. It all has to spring from the character. I mean, what's the difference between a superhero and just some good guy?
Yeah.
And it's the bat cape, right? It's the symbol, it's the car, it's the stuff, it's the backstory, it's what's the difference between just a guy and Spider-Man, you know, other than he has super strength? I mean, it's the costume. It's that he was bit by a radioactive spider. What we're interested in, when somebody watches a play or a character on stage, I believe when I work for my character, they want to know, what are this individual's powers? What are his powers? Where did they come from? How has he developed them? Why does he want to share them with me?
Mm-hmm.
What as an audience should I take away from this? How does performing tonight's performance change the performer? How is the performer forever changed because we have shared this experience together? What are the performer's weaknesses? Not only what can he do, but what can't he do? Like Superman is scared of kryptonite and Batman has his parent issues and can be hurt with a bullet or a gun. I think knowing our journey, knowing, you know, the character, Harry Potter's journey, and where he came from and what he's reaching for and what he really wants is to have a greater connection to his parents. And he has this parcel tongue connection to the evil guy. And
mm-hmm.
discovering these things about the character throughout, for me, I found that my audiences care a lot more about that than they care about the tricks I do. When we look at historical characters, Moses lived an entire life of 400 years. But the one magic trick we think of him doing, you know, not magic trick, but God, is splitting the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea, as we now call it.
Mm-hmm.
And 400 years this guy lived, but that's the one thing they talk about.
Right?
So you don't have to have 500 tricks per year. You can do one if you do it well.
And be well known for the
and be
eternity.
Well known for it right.
for a long time as well. I thought it was interesting last night, one of the things in the lecture you had mentioned was the development of character, not just your character, but how you create characters out of the audience.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? I think that's fantastic.
Absolutely.
I thought I got a lot out of that. That's great.
So as a mentalist, I don't have a female assistant in my show. I don't have other actors. I don't have other interaction with other people. I don't have set pieces. I don't tend to have costume changes. Yet I am putting on a play. I am writing a story. And when I look at a play...
In real time, you're writing in real time, yeah.
And when I'm putting on a play or I'm putting on a musical, I have other characters. So who are the other characters that a mentalist has to work with? I mean, I break the fourth wall. I'm interacting with people. So I have built into my show, okay, which pile are you going to take? Are you going to be nice and take the pile I placed in front of you? Or rude and take my pile? And they say, I'll be rude and take your pile. Oh, I wouldn't have guessed that of you. Then I point to someone in the audience and I say, but you would have been nice. And now for the rest of the show, this is the rude guy and that's the nice girl, right? And I have other people where I'll ask them, do you have any pets? You know, what kind of pets do you have? Wow, you're one cat away from Crazy Cat Lady. And then that's the Crazy Cat Lady, right? Who loves pets, or Dr. Doolittle, or however I want to play it. And whatever they say, you know, what was your favorite subject in school? Very often people say girls or boys were my favorite subject in school. And now I can use that whenever somebody's being flirty or someone says, I say, you know, are you dating? No, I'm single. You know, she's looking.
Yeah.
Right? Her favorite subject is...
So you got callbacks throughout the
show. Callbacks throughout the show where the audience members become characters as part of my story.
I like that. Rather than saying, okay, what is your name? And so it's Alice or whatever. And so, well, you ought to talk to Alice. It's funny, you're by using the descriptive words and saying she's looking for somebody
right
there, rather than saying Alice.
Alice.
Because they may not remember that she was the one who was looking for somebody because there were other people.
Right.
And it's just reminding them of what it is that character's part is in this play you're creating.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so as you're doing that, you're creating more and more characters. And then at the end, do you wrap it up by, you know, thanking each of the people?
Yes, absolutely. And I have, you know, and the person who did a great William Shatner impersonation, and the girl that was scared of lying, and the guy that was read, and I go through these. And I say, everybody who came up on stage and helped me out, give, you know, stand up. Let's give them a round of applause. Weren't they amazing? I mean, they really made the show. This show would have been a very different show without these wonderful people. And so to so-and-so, who each did this and did that.
Yeah.
Gee, they're fantastic. One more time for all of them.
Right.
I hope you've enjoyed this show as much as I did. I had a great time because of you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this isn't just another stop in another place of me doing another show. This show changed my life. I am different because of this, right?
Along that line, I thought that was another fascinating thing where that you have a Zenner card deck that you're going through mm-hmm. and trying to get them to match. And then once they do match, then you kind of say under your breath.
Oh, right. So I start out the presentation as if this person is not going to make any of these match. I do this city after city, and I'm going to talk to you about how I debunk fake psychics.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about how I've worked at different casinos, and I've done different things with fake psychics and all that. And then this person, their cards match.
Yeah. And suddenly the tone changes.
And suddenly the tone changes. Because deep down, the guy that's the skeptic is a skeptic because he's angry. Because he really wanted the magic to be real. And when he found it wasn't, it hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's an angry, hurt child. But here we are. Maybe I found the one real psychic. And so the tone suddenly changes because this person got them all right. And I say, wow, give them a round of applause. And while the audience is applauding, with my microphone still on, I say, you and I need to talk after the show. And usually they come up to me, and what I do is I give them a headshot. But as far as the audience is concerned, I need to talk to them because they're a real psychic. Then I send them back to their seat, and I say to the audience, look, seriously, I was going to use this moment to talk about how this never happens, but I need to grab a photo of this. And I pull out my camera, and I take a photo of the table with the Zenner cards on it.
All matching.
Well, all matching. And I say to the guy, what was your full name again? And I type in his full name into my thing. I say, that's great. Thank you very much. Talk to me after the show. And then I'm thrown for a minute. I said, well, normally what I do with casinos is when I deal with psychics, I do this and this and this and this.
Right.
And then I continue on with the show a little bit flustered for a moment. And the audience wonders.
Was he really?
Was he really?
Yeah.
Was that guy really psychic?
Uh-huh.
I was there the night that he had a real psychic.
And that's the moment you want to create so people not just talking about, oh, he did this trick or that trick, but I was there the night that.
That.
Such and such happened.
I was there the night that.
Yeah.
And the same is true when I do improv acting. Mm-hmm. Today is the day that. And it has to be, when I'm performing something on stage, it better be the most important day of my life. Otherwise, there are more interesting things to watch.
Yeah.
There are far more interesting things to watch. When you watch a movie, you're not watching the entire lifespan of the character. You're watching the day that they mm-hmm. were in a car accident, the day that the aliens invaded, the day that, or the moments that. And so, well, it's the most important moment of that character's life. So when I'm up on stage performing, this isn't just show 12 of 500. This is the day that
mm-hmm.
it was Tommy's birthday.
And so you try to put that into every
waiting,
show.
And I've been waiting all day long for Tommy's birthday.
Yeah.
Right?
Because it's an important moment in their lives, and you want to show that that's important to you
to
as
me
well.
Too.
And you're just not mailing it in.
Right.
Yeah. That's great. Now, as far as other types of shows that you do, you had gotten started doing some mentalism. You told me earlier you were inspired by seeing Banachek, and you've seen Richard Osterlund, Mark Salem, some other guys,
all
these guys, sure, that you had been inspired by, but you decided that mentalism was really more for you than the boxes and being the next Copperfield.
Oh, absolutely. Right. When I was little, I wanted to be Harry Blackstone Jr. I mean, place one hand here, one here, one here. No, the clean one, Tommy. You know, in the Himalaya Mountains. You know, Harry Blackstone Jr. was great. I mean, I wanted to be him. But I was also fascinated with, I had the Carl Fulvis book on suffering mental magic.
Mm-hmm.
I had a fellow that worked, Gil Martinez, that worked in a magic shop in Vegas when I was little. He convinced me to buy Corinda, right, by showing me a center tear and telling me that it was in that book. But seeing Banachek's book, Psychological Subtleties, is where I really looked at it and said, you know, this is magic that matters. This is magic that matters. Because at the end of the day, after watching Magician, though it's visual and beautiful, I don't walk away and say, you know, I wish. I wish I had the ability to turn a white handkerchief into a red handkerchief. Mm-hmm. Gee, wouldn't that be amazing? My life would be forever better
right.
if I could do that. But I do look at it and I say, if I could know what that girl was thinking, if I could know what would make my wife really happy, if I could know what my boss was thinking, or what my teacher really wanted the answer to be on this test, or what the car salesman's real lowest price would be,
right.
if I had those powers, that would help me in my life. And because of that, performing for people who are doctors, lawyers, salespeople, mentalism is very appealing to them. Now, when performing for cattle ranchers, mentalism isn't as appealing because it doesn't affect their day-to-day life except for wives, children, and selling the cattle.
Mm-hmm.
But to people that are in people positions, mentalism is really the magic that they want to see because it's the magic that they wish they could harness.
True. You know, I mentioned on the podcast here before that I have done many shows, closing dinners for financial institutions when they'll have some initial public offerings, and it'll be a small group of board of directors, CEO from a couple of companies, maybe about only 12 people there. And I get called back time and again to appear on behalf of the financial institution who is sponsoring these dinners. However, a few times I couldn't make it, and I've had Banachek fill in, and the corporations will call Banachek back to come and do something there. And I asked the financial institution, why is it you think, you know, they're calling him rather than me? Not that I'm jealous, I'm just curious. You know, what is it he has or does as a mentalism, aside from that, that he, they say, reaches into their mind. Said they know what you are doing is fun, it's funny, it's sleight of hand. They don't know how it's done, but they're having a good time. And I guess like Michael Marr would say, it's bubblegum for the eyes. You know,
right.
it's something that's just fun. But however, they're dealing with numbers. They're dealing with personnel. They're dealing with, you know, hard issues that will affect the lives of many people and, you know, millions of dollars every day. And for somebody to reach in their mind and not just know what they're thinking, but how they're thinking, which
right.
is the subtlety, of course, that is unique to Banachek, that he tells somebody, you know, about, you know, the how, and not just a prediction, you know, kind of a thing. So the point is that they want to have him come back and, you know, try to study that, you know, hear it again. So wait a minute, how did he know that? Let's try that again, you know,
right.
see if he can do it again. And so they seem to like that. It's when the more, I'd say more intelligent, maybe the higher within business executives that they go, that they tend to kind of, you know, look to mentalism to be more real, if you will, than magic. And I think in general, people think of mentalism as being real because they want to believe. That's something you don't understand.
Right. It's a superpower they want.
They want, yeah.
And so that's why some of us want to be Superman, because Superman grew up on another planet and came here. But some of us want to be Batman because he's just a guy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned also in the lecture about working for children
right.
And doing mentalism. And some people say, well, you can't do mentalism for children. You say, nay.
Of course you can. So I was originally trained when I was little by a magician in Salt Lake City named Paul Brewer, who does about 500 shows a year out there. And Paul Brewer has given me a lot of great advice as a professional working guy. There's also a great magician out there named Christopher Fair, who Steve Martin talks about in his book, Born Standing Up. That Chris Fair was the original magician at Disneyland, the original court jester there when Disney opened. And you know, mentalism, I want to perform in performing art venues as mm-hmm. well as corporate events. So in these performing art venues and theaters around the country, they want to know, can families come to this show? And I want to be able to say, yes,
sure.
families can come to this show.
It's acceptable, and they'd understand it.
And they'd understand it, and nothing I'm doing is dirty or crude or nasty. And they want to know, well, can a child understand what it is that you do? And I say to them, any child that can understand, if I could read my teacher's mind, I could have better grades. If I could read my older brother, older sister's mind, maybe they'd take me with them to the movies. If I could read my parents' mind, I'd know whether 5 minutes more in the park really meant 15 or not.
Yeah.
And I have to express that. I have to care about the thoughts of a child. See, if I'm a mind reader, I have to understand what it would be like to live the life of a mind reader. If I can really read minds, how do I see the world? Now, someone like Max Maven may say, was a mind reader, I'm listening to people, and they're all predictable and boring, and I hate them. I don't know if that's his perspective. Or am I a Chan Canasta who says, I can't read people's thoughts, I can just control their actions? Or am I a character like a fictional character that can read minds? You know, characters that can read minds religiously, God. Fictionally, Santa Claus, right? These individuals are happy. They like you. They read your thoughts, and they like you as a person. And they care about you, and they empathize with you. Santa Claus knows if you're naughty or nice. He knows if you've been good or bad. He knows when you're sleeping. Santa Claus is a mind reader. I mean, Santa Claus, my core characters that I try and base myself on, fictional characters, Santa Claus, Indiana Jones, because he's an archaeologist, I'm an anthropologist,
right.
Willy Wonka, a collector of strange, unusual things that's going to take you on this adventure. These are Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. who is able to look at people and have deductive reasoning, and he's just a guy. You know, he's Indiana Jones, just a guy. Sherlock Holmes, you know, these guys, other than Santa Claus, who's magical, right. but they're just guys, right? And that's an important part of my sense of being. So as a mind reader character, I am reading people's minds, not just the person standing in front of me, but everyone in the audience.
A child or adult.
A child or adult, and I'm empathizing with them, and I care about them as a human being. I care mm-hmm. about them as an individual because I'm inside their thoughts, and that's a very delicate place to be. And for me, if I'm not delicate and kind with that, then that's really invasive and hurtful,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as places where you work, again, that you said, like in this particular case, that if there are families going to be a part of your act, that the guy who's booking you will say, look, we're going to be having children, or is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
I see people like Elaine New, Craig Cargas, of course, Banachek, and many other mentalists who are working the college circuit, and that's really not your thing, although you've done everything. We were talking about last evening,
right.
you know, with cruise ships and of course, casinos and big in Vegas, et cetera, et cetera. But your core bread and butter is not working in the college circuit.
Correct.
So how do you go about marketing yourself?
I find an audience with money.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that audience is technology companies, cruise ships, universities, or even county fairs in the wealthiest counties in America, right? And I find an audience with money. Then I find out what their needs are, and then I build a show to fulfill their needs, and then I sell it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am very variety-driven. I want to see every museum and national park and zoo in the world. I want to see every theme park. I want to interact with people everywhere. I want to learn everywhere.
Right.
And so I wake up and I say, all right, next quarter, if I could go anywhere, if I could be anywhere, if I could eat any kind of food or see, you know, Jack Hanna's new zoo in Columbus, Ohio and all the upgrades, what do I have to do to go there?
Yeah.
Who has money in that area? So I'm not as much driven by a certain area of performance, as I'm a performer,
mm-hmm.
and I use mentalism as my means of performance. But I am driven by having a very high quality of life.
Yeah,
and so I make my choices based on having that high quality of life. My core needs are to educate others, to entertain others, to have enough money that I'm not in want. That's mm-hmm. not being super wealthy,
right.
Though I do have homes in L.A., Vegas, and Salt Lake City,
yeah.
right? And to have a career that my grandmother would find respectable.
Because
if all I wanted was money, I mean, sell drugs, right?
The ways of doing it.
If all I want is to be famous,
below the law.
If all I want to do is be famous, go kill a celebrity.
Yeah.
Right? But those are my core needs,
uh-huh.
and I fulfill them.
I thought it was interesting, again, in the lecture where you were talking about marketing, that there was from the bottom up and the top down. Now, you talked about
right.
just right there from the bottom up where you find this. Talk about the other way down.
So the artist's journey versus the entrepreneur's journey. And this is a book that I'm writing right now for Murphy's Magic. And it's mm-hmm. The difference between the artist's journey and the entrepreneur's journey. The artist's journey is, and it's the same journey, but they're reciprocal of each other. The artist's journey is I start with myself. Then I add my passions. In our case, our passion is magic. But let's say our passion is painting dead cats. And then after I add my passions, I create the product. I paint a painting of a dead cat.
Mm-hmm.
Then I find someone who has a need, like standing out on a street corner in Oliver, you know, the musical Oliver. Who will buy this wonderful morning, right? Will someone buy this painting and or going to an art festival or an art fair? And then I find the buyer and I sell it to them. That's the starving artist's journey, because you are doing your art, your passion, you create what you create, and then you hope someone will buy it. And that's what many people do. They find the magic tricks that fool them, they buy them, they put them in order, and then they hope someone will buy them doing that.
It's like fishing, I guess. You just kind of throw the bobber out and hope there's a fish that picks up that bait.
But what if you really like the desert and you want to go fishing in the desert? I mean, you're going to be a long time before you find someone.
That's right.
Or put a billboard in the middle of nowhere. You have to drive people to it.
Yeah.
So the opposite journey, the sellout journey, mm-hmm. the entrepreneur's journey, is you start with the buyer. You say, who is a buyer? Technology companies. What are their needs? Every January, they come out and they say, look how innovative we are and how innovative we're going to be for this new year.
Mm-hmm.
And then you build a show that fulfills their needs. I'm going to build a show that talks all about innovation and talks all about the innovation of whatever company I'm working for. Innovation, insert your company name here. And it's a big extravaganza show or trade show for that. And then I'm going to add in my passion, magic,
yeah.
and then I'm going to cast myself to play that role.
Right.
And so the question is, do I start with the buyer and then create something to sell to them, in which case I'm going to be very successful because I'm fulfilling people's needs? Or am I going to be an artist and create my art, thus fulfilling my own needs,
mm-hmm.
and then hope that somebody else likes my art? They're both good journeys, and we both take both journeys.
Sure.
You know, Kreskin still tells his stories and talks and sings and does stuff in his show, right?
Right.
And those aren't necessarily the best choices for being the entrepreneur. But other things he's done have been the best choices for being the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So we do both in our experience, because we are, at the end of the day, we're not craftsmen. We are attempting to be art.
Let me ask you about disclaimers.
Sure.
That there are different schools of thoughts of whether you should or shouldn't give disclaimers, or just not referring to anything at all of you having certain powers. And in your show that you're trying to create a character that you have these abilities or something, but at the end of the show that you don't say, well, this was all just a sham or anything. So I think you choose not to use disclaimers.
Correct.
Talk a little bit about
that. Sure, absolutely. So, I have a clear understanding of who my character is and what my powers are. I am a mortal man. Like Sherlock Holmes, like Indiana Jones, I can look at people, look at situations, and know things about them. This comes from my training as a cultural anthropologist. That is my character. I can do some other things because as a boy I loved magic. And because as an anthropologist I've gone and spent time with spiritualists, with cannibals, with shamans, and that's true, and I've learned the things that they are able to do, and I can recreate what it is they do. Mm-hmm. But even there, I am recreating what they do. So I am not a magical man. I am a man that has met magical men.
Okay.
Right? So that's the difference.
Right.
So when people, because I know who I am, and I don't think a lot of performers know who they are, and have thought about it. I think they just have a series of tricks in order.
Yeah.
But because I know who I am, I know how to answer the question. When someone comes up to me after a show and says, can you predict the lottery numbers? No, because I can't predict the future. I know things about people. If they're standing in front of me, I can tell you about people. But my skill set is in people. Can you tell me if my dead mother knows that I love her? No, I can't talk to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure she does, because just looking at you, you're a lovely person, and I'm sure that she loves you. So knowing your character, knowing who you are, is my disclaimer. Now, also, because I feel a desire to, I have a piece in my show that is artistic choice for me, not necessarily best character choice, where I do the linking rings. The medalist does the linking rings.
Wow.
But then again,
yeah.
Alexander the Man Who Knows did the linking rings.
Anneman
did the linking rings. Dunninger did the linking rings. Alcoran did the linking finger rings. The Evisons did the linking finger rings.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a long history of linking rings.
Right.
And if you're going to bend metal with your spoon, why not link rings, right? But and I sing Pure Imagination from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the original one. And this song, if we're going to create this journey of pure imagination. And so if somebody really pushes me, I say, just like the piece with the rings, where I sang about creating a world of pure imagination, I'm glad that you enjoyed this journey that we went on, this show, this fun, this
entertainment. You kind of changed the direction of the question.
I changed the direction. If it becomes, if suddenly I find that I have become the prophet of a religion that I don't believe in.
Yeah.
If suddenly I find, and this is, mentalists are often prophets for a religion they don't believe in. If suddenly I find that I am fulfilling the religious needs of this individual who needs to believe that there are psychics out there, and it's going to change their life in a way that I'm not, that they are going to need to interact with me as a spiritual advisor.
Right.
That's not the role that I want to play in life. Some mentalists do. Uri Geller enjoyed being a spiritual advisor.
Right.
That's not my journey. Mm-hmm. There was a time, you know, I officiate weddings, you officiate weddings.
Sure.
There was a time I wanted to be a rabbinical chaplain in the Air Force. But that's not where I went. Even though I studied religious and cognitive anthropology, I am not a spiritual leader, and I don't have my master's degree in social work, and I am a show person.
Yeah.
Putting on an entertainment that is certainly wish fulfillment. Mm-hmm. In so much as any play is dream fulfillment. But I don't think that everybody who watches Peter Pan thinks that Mary Martin is really a little boy who lives on an island, talks to mermaids, and can fly. And I don't think there are too many incidences of children in England jumping out of their windows trying to go to Neverland.
Yeah. So there would be no reason for you to dispel whatever thoughts that they might happen to have about you.
In a big way, the proscenium is my disclaimer.
Yes, yeah. Now, you kind of went into or alluded a little bit about cold reading, and we discussed that at last night's lecture then, too. And you got some really great tips and ideas on cold reading. But the question I have has to do with responding to people who really believe. Like you were just talking a moment ago about those who are searching for some religion or for something to believe, or they think that there are psychics that are real or whatever. When it comes to that, rather than having a disclaimer, what do you say to those whenever that you say, like in the cold reading you were explaining last night, you have three questions. It's kind of like the genie in the lamp, you know, what's your three questions, and one of them is, you know, will my child be okay who's in the hospital, you know,
right.
Or, you know, that will I be getting, you know, this cancer, you know, leave my body, or
right.
You know, how long will it take for me to, you know, those kinds of hard questions. My question to you is, how do you answer those kinds of hard questions?
By understanding what my powers are. Again, I go back to that, and that helps me choose what effects to do in my show. I look at them and I say, the card doesn't answer that. But what the card does say is... And then I say something
positive. So again, you kind of take it in a different...
Right. When I'm doing a reading for someone, I don't have a death card, a hermit card, a tower, I don't have any of these cards in my deck. I get rid of those. Because this is an opportunity for me to share kindness with people. This is an opportunity for me to write my self-help book that makes people feel happy. My chicken soup for the soul, part 39, right?
Yeah.
That's some pretty watered down chicken soup by that point. But that's my goal is to take these core things that I think matter, to love this person who's sitting here with me. Actually, I'm not here to take their money. I'm here to love them and care about them. They're giving me an opportunity to love them. They're giving me an opportunity to tell them that they're a good person, that yes, the world is hard, but things are going to get better, and that through being kind to others, that they themselves will be happy.
Mm-hmm.
They are giving me an opportunity to share my core values and core message as a person and to spread that love to other people. So if they ask questions, you know, my last two children have died, stillborn, is this child, and I'm currently pregnant.
Yeah.
I say the card doesn't answer that. But what the card does say is that there are lots of people that love you and care about you. I mean, more people than you even know. And whether it's going to be this child or your next child, or you adopt a child, or you're great to other children, you're just loved. I mean, do you know how many people you affect day to day?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what the card tells me. And that's far more important to me.
Sure.
If somebody comes to me and says, I'm thinking about doing something, should I do it? I'm not going to say yes, and I'm not going to say no.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, you know what the kind, good choice is, not the short-term choice, but the long-term choice that makes the most people feel like they've been good in the eyes of, I don't know if you're religious or not, but but there are bad choices, they're hurtful choices, they're choices that feel like they'd be a good choice in the short term, but in the long term hurt a lot of people.
And have consequences.
And have consequences. Mm-hmm. So what the card says to me is that you should seek advice from other people that you trust who are outside of this situation.
You sound like a clinical psychologist or a therapist from the standpoint that you are asking, well, what do you think? You know,
right.
I've done cold reading and I've seen some other people do that. You're picking up on body language where they're nodding or they're not, and they're and whether they're crossing their legs, et cetera, or whether that they're in agreement and you're happening to get the right answers. But I noticed, and I learned a lot from you then last night in saying that you're not watching for those so much. I mean, yes, you are using that in total. However, that you are saying, how does that feel for you? You keep asking for justification and make sure that you're going the right direction and basically saying back to them what they just told you.
Very much. I use a lot of cognitive therapy. I'm a big fan of the field of symbolic anthropology that we are. The humans are symbol-bearing animals, so that's something that separates us from other animals, is that other animals use tools, but they tend to use symbols, and that we communicate back and forth in imagery. And so, yes, I ask people, well, what does that mean to you? Well, how does that hit you? Well, explain to me what's going on in your life with that. And they walk away from that experience feeling as if I knew all of those core things when really they told me. Now, I also use cold reading. For example, I'm looking at you right now. You have a brand new pair of shoes, so I know that you have enough money to afford a pair of shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You happen to be at home not working today, so you're wearing sneakers. And I know that that means that you're a person that values comfort and values the essence of what the shoe does for you. It's not a big name brand shoe because the purpose of the shoe is not to be a name brand, but to be comfortable, that you have clean socks on, new socks. So I know that you have enough money to buy new socks and throw away your old, and you're not a hoarder, right? You're currently wearing shorts, which you may not want people to know, but that lets me know that you have a positive body image of yourself, because people that don't wear shorts, right? There are things that I know by looking at a person and caring about them, by seeing are they okay with their shoes, are they okay with their socks, are they okay, and by actually caring about a person and observing them in real time, I can tell you a lot about them just by empathizing with them.
And it's not just during the cold read that you do on a one-on-one, but also on stage when you're
having
people. Yeah.
If I see somebody in stripes, I'm going to make a joke about them looking like a prisoner. If I see somebody today, when I went to the bank, the girl had on very vibrant colors. I could see the edge of her bra was red, her undershirt under her shirt was bright, vibrant orange, and her main shirt was bright turquoise. And I said to her, boy, you're a very vibrant person. I bet your home is filled with vibrant, beautiful colors, just like the clothing you're wearing. You're really big energy and love to share happiness with people. And she said, oh, yes, I do like vibrant colors. And my house, I have different walls painted different colors. And she'll walk away saying, this guy came in and knew what my house looked like.
And it made her feel better about herself
and
her choices.
And that's something a mentalist can do. That's something a mentalist can do, is walk around and plant flowers in people's minds wherever we go.
Wow, I love that. Yeah. You know, there was something else that you had said, completely off the subject of everything else we kind of talked about, but you live in Las Vegas, and you had told me that the difference between Las Vegas and New Orleans.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's a classic.
But the difference between Las Vegas and New Orleans, because I just spent some time in New Orleans, and previously I had spent 6 weeks there when I was studying spiritualists, but Las Vegas, the drinks are free if you sit and play the casino games.
Right.
The drinks are free. But the nude girls are very expensive. In New Orleans, nude girls are free, but the drinks are very expensive. And so, as a non-drinker myself, New Orleans is a great city.
Yeah. That's funny. It's funny. So, do you like Los Angeles or Las Vegas?
You know, different places for different purposes.
Sure.
Las Vegas is great because I can have a 5-bedroom house for the same money that in Los Angeles I have a condo, right? Yeah. A little condo. And so there's that disparate experience there. Mm-hmm. Las Vegas is nice in that I can still drive out and see wooded areas or desert areas or beautiful silicate rock sculpture and stone, you know, that have been carved through time. I can drive to the Grand Canyon. I can drive there. Los Angeles is great because it's filled with opportunity. Los Angeles creates art that is seen by the world. If you're famous in Vegas, you're often Vegas famous. If you're famous in New York, you're often New York famous. But the things that are created, the magic that's created in Hollywood, TV, film, all of this, is seen by the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's changing right now because of YouTube and because people creating their own mediums.
Own content, right.
And their own content, like what we're doing right here.
Right.
And that content is being created everywhere. But Hollywood is still a hub for accessing the world. And I like it very much for that. Now, Vegas is good for me because I'm 4 hours away by car from L.A.,
mm-hmm.
or I'm a one-hour airplane flight. And I'm 8 hours drive, 7 hours drive to Salt Lake, so I can do it in a day, or I'm an hour and a half flight. The casinos in Vegas subsidize the flights, and so it's very inexpensive to fly in and out of Vegas. So there are a lot of benefits to Vegas that way. But I do miss the beauty of the ocean, of rivers, of mountains, of streams, of Utah and California. And that's why I continue to maintain residence there. I'm in Vegas less than 100 days a year. In a very real way, when I go to my home in Vegas, I feel like I'm in a Paul Draper-themed house rather than my actual
yeah,
home.
Yeah, but it still feels comfortable, obviously, right. when you come home, or, quote, home.
Right.
Home. Well, let me ask you then, for the 100 days that you are there, it seems that, or even further, before, when you were staying there on a more regular basis,
right.
and house magician at the Venetian and all that, with the hundreds of magicians who have tried to make it and haven't, what has been your secret? I mean, how have you been successful in Vegas that others haven't been quite so?
Right. Let me tell you some advice that I received when I first moved to Vegas.
Hmm.
When I first moved to Vegas. Jeff McBride said to me, there's enough work in Vegas that if you're good, you can get work here. He was right.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Chaney, who was the original Mr. Clown on Ringling Brothers and one of the first Ronald McDonalds, he ran Planet Mirth Magic Shop for years in Vegas. He said, "I let everybody know that I would a fish,
yeah.
right for 5 cents." Mm-hmm. He says, "Let people know that I'm ready to work. I'm available to work. Let people know that I will say yes to work." And that's important too. Is let people know that you're available and that you have a good quality product. Bram Charles said to me, the best magicians in the world move to Vegas, and you better be ready for it. And that, I don't think is true.
Hmm.
I think the third best magicians in the world move to Vegas.
Interesting.
I think the first and second best are making so much money in their hometown that they don't need to leave their families, they don't need to leave their friends,
mm-hmm.
they don't need to leave their hometown, because they're making enough money there to sustain. But the third best, he's got to go to Vegas so that he can make a life for himself, because he's not making it in his hometown.
And so they can't really be successful there if they're third best.
Right, and so it's hard if you're third best. So I would say don't move to Vegas unless you have already established yourself somewhere else, and you're coming to Vegas because you have a job there. You're coming to Vegas because you have a show there. Or don't move to Vegas unless you are ready to put out a lot of money right now.
Yeah.
Because the casinos are no longer hiring entertainers. They are renting rooms. And so unless you are ready to rent that room,
which is called four-walling.
Four-walling. And put up that $10,000 a month in advertising
mm-hmm.
from your own pocket,
right.
It's really the wrong town. Why it's been able to work for me is I haven't tried to have the Vegas show on the Strip. I've worked for casinos. I taught at the university there for a while. I'm not doing that anymore. But that initially when I came in was to teach at the university.
Yeah.
And then I left that to do that. I have been the guy that has performed for the high rollers of different casinos, fulfilling the needs of these different casinos, fulfilling their needs. So they hire me because I'm fulfilling their needs rather than asking them to fulfill mine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing. Most guys move out to Vegas. They bring all their stuff out there. They try to make it happen. They say, I sure hope someone will buy me. I love magic, they say. I love magic. I love magic my whole life. I don't have a show. I've never performed anywhere. I don't know who to sell it to, but I love magic.
Yeah.
And I hope I'll move to Vegas and some magical person will see me and say, you love magic? I've been waiting my whole life to meet someone who loved magic. Well, I'm going to help you, and I'll get you a costume and a stage, and I'll tell you which tricks to use, and I'll build you a show, and I'll do it all for you. And, you know, if you run into Peter Raveen, you know, 30 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
But other than that, I've never heard of that happening.
Right.
And so it's not going to be that way. And so these guys come to Vegas, they're there for 6 months, they run out of money, they end up selling all their magic to Gary Darwin, so they can buy a plane ticket home. And so the guys in Vegas that have been in Vegas a long time have amazing collections of magic built on the sorrow of magicians.
On the backs, sorrowful backs of others. Interesting. Well, now, you said that Los Angeles is just a four-hour drive away, and you were one of the performers recently at the 50th anniversary celebration for... Well,
went to the 50th anniversary
there.
It was great.
Tell me something about that and how it was and what all you did.
What an amazing experience. I mean, Siegfried was there, and Irene Larson and Milt Larson.
Neil Patrick Harris.
Neil Patrick Harris, of course, who's our current president, and Steve Valentine was the MC of the event, and Jack Goldfinger and Dove were there. It was, you know, there to support, of course, the Board of Trustees with, like, John Armstrong and
Whit Hayden
and Rob Zabrecki, you know, great, Erica Larson, Liberty Larson, wonderful people. Milt performed on stage that evening. It was really a great event to say, look at this, since 1963, the Magic Castle has been alive for 50 years.
Yeah.
And other than the short time period they had to close because of the fire, they shouldn't have named their Halloween show The Inferno, should they? And
live and learn,
yeah. Right? And but they've been able to make it happen where other places just haven't.
True.
I mean, it's been amazing. They have the right location, the right energy, the right feel.
The right people.
They went classy as their theme rather than kitsch, right? Because the new kitsch place gets a big boost of energy, but then slowly becomes hackneyed.
Yeah, it's a shooting star.
But the classic place starts slow and builds up. And in the same way, the Magic Castle didn't open as what it is today with, you know, what, five bars and seven performance areas and all that. They were one room, one bar. And they've expanded.
And Milt kept building,
Kept building. And it took a team effort, not just one individual, but a whole family of people that made it happen. And so to celebrate that was so wonderful. And one of the things I bought that was very lovely is one of the people that work up in the office of the castle took some of the wood that was pulled out of the castle after the fire, after the after they fixed it up there, after the refurb, right? And he turned some of these pieces of wood from the Dante room, the devil room, into Ouija boards.
Wow.
So Ouija boards made from the Dante room at the Magic Castle the day it was caught on fire. So I bought one of those. And
wow.
So
that would be
very,
cool.
Very nice things, you know, and nice people who have come together. And there were several people that were there on opening day when the castle opened.
50 years ago.
50 years ago that were here, alive, ready to celebrate. Also, Elvira was there. Marianne from Gilligan's Island was there. One of the cast members from the original Dukes of Hazzard was there. You know, Don Wells. And I mean, it was great. It was really, really a spectacular event.
And you did close-up with Lance Burton and Amazing Jonathan?
Well, Lance wasn't there. Sent in a little video. Amazing Jonathan performed on stage. I did some strolling. We had the full lineup of regular performers in there. It was really a big, beautiful event.
Not to be recreated again, probably, for another 50 years.
Right. And it'll be very different.
Yeah.
It'll be very different. And Jonathan Pendragon was there with his new wife, Wes, who holds the lease, the contract, for the ground the Magic Castle is on.
She does?
She does. Her family does. She's the representative there of the Gower family.
I thought it was the Glover family.
Glover family.
The Glover family. So she was an heir to the Glover family.
Yes. She talked about how as a little girl, that she used to come to the Magic Castle with her family, and she used to love it, and they would waive the age restriction, right, because their family owned the property on a handshake deal. They gave it to Melton, and that she fell in love with a young performer, Jonathan, there, and years later, they've reconnected and now been married.
You know what I find as kind of strange and funny about this, because, of course, Pendragon is not his real name, but Jonathan had taken on that name, of course, Uther Pendragon, of being, you know, the king,
King Arthur's
father, and how that kings would acquire other lands by marrying their daughters.
Right.
And so here that Jonathan is marrying someone who has the property, so that way he can continue to keep this magical
castle.
Camelot alive.
Right. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Quite serendipitous.
Quite a story.
Yeah.
But she talked about and shared that story of her experiences as a young girl at the castle and her being in love with Jonathan. And it was really a nice tribute.
How interesting. Okay, well, we start to kind of wrap up over here. I always like to find out what kind of advice that visiting magicians have for youth. I mean, as far as getting involved, what direction they should have in their life, what they should study, whether they should consider doing this full-time or not, and, you know, what do you think?
So what age youth are we talking about? Who would I be speaking to?
You know, that's a good question, because, as you said, when you were a child, you were influenced by Harry Blackstone Jr., and you said, I want to be that guy. Of course, at 7 or 8 year old, that it's kind of young to be, but it's something that does influence you for the rest of your life. But at some point when, usually I'd probably say a high school youth, if you're junior or senior, and you've been doing some magic and entertaining the kids, you know, in the band or in the...
So let's talk about that. I was national debate champion in original oratory for debate. I did debate in high school. And I went to the national level 2 years in a row. Several kids made fun of me that I kept winning just because I had such a great voice. It's just your voice. If you didn't have that voice, you wouldn't be able to win. So it made me so angry that I built a pantomime show. And I did the state competition, and I won 3rd in state in pantomime, just so I could do it without the voice. So I took debate, I took theater, I took singing lessons, so I understood the voice. I took dance classes, though it doesn't look like it, but I did, and movement classes. And I'm not a great dancer, but I can move. And I worked with the stage crew, and I worked backstage, and I learned about lighting and about sets. And about moving sets and moving these props around and what is capable and isn't capable and seeing it from the perspective of the front of the house. I also went to a lot of magic shows, especially bad magic shows.
Sure.
Because I learned more from bad magic shows by sitting there and saying, instead of saying, oh, this is so terrible, but instead saying, what could I do to make this better?
What if?
What if this was me, what would I wish that someone would say to me, and I don't say it to them, but I say, what do I wish I could do here? And seeing not just magic shows, but comedians, variety artists, theatrical productions, because we are a theatrical medium, and we can bring in all of those things. A comedian, all he has is a stool and a microphone, yet he can entertain a huge crowd. A play has a stool, a microphone, a set, other characters. A musical has a stool, a microphone, a set, other characters, music, an orchestra. A magician has access to all of those things, plus magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so in truth, we should be better and greater and grander than any of those mediums, but we're not. Mm-hmm. And why are we not? Because most magicians, I find, see a trick that fools them. They learn it. They show it to someone else. That someone else says, wow, that's amazing. And the magician says, oh, you found that amazing? Yeah, that was amazing. Yeah. And the magician says, good enough. I don't have to do anything else with that. That's good enough. It's done. It's
Move
in
on.
The show.
Yeah.
It fooled them. My job is to fool. And my argument to any young student is your job is not to fool. That is a part of your job. Your job is to create a theatrical experience. And so spend as much time in debate, theater, music, dance, stage management, business classes, marketing, public relations as you possibly can. Read as many different topics as you can on performance and the business of performance and the theory of performance, and be a full, rounded entertainer, not just a magician.
That's good advice. And basically stay in school, out of high school, go on to college.
Right. I went to college, to graduate school, and I'm very glad that I did that.
Yeah. And not just because you have something then that you can have as a backup, but then you can have this. I mean, look at Joshua Jay. There's a fellow that had a vision of what he wanted to do, and he knew he wanted to be a magician, and he went to college with the decision that as soon as he graduated, he was going to go into being a full-time professional magician, which he has and been successful as well.
But being an educated person.
Yes.
And being able to interact and interface with other educated people and to share experiences with them and have that shared experience
makes
a big difference.
That's a very good point, because if you want to make the big dollars, there's nothing wrong with doing birthday parties at all. However, that the difference between birthday parties and corporate parties is zero at the end of that paycheck, or more. That you can add to it, because if you're going to be interacting and wanting to work with the adults who are the corporate executives who are paying those kinds of things, they need to appreciate you, and you need to speak their language, with contracts, your W-9 form, your taxes, with the sound, the light. So that way they know that you are the expert and that you are handling it in a business-like manner. If you're doing it like that, it is just something that's kind of off the cuff. That's not what they're used to dealing with, and you need to understand the business of magic.
So here's a mean thing that I sometimes say to young magicians.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, look, I'm going to share a secret with you. And I've never shared this with anybody else, but I'm going to share it with you. If you really want to be successful in magic, there's a guy named Jones, Mr. Jones, and he lives in Colorado. And he books shows all over the world. I mean, big, big money shows and cruise ships and theaters and everything. And he likes magicians, but he doesn't have the right guy. And you might be him. What you need to do is get him a headshot. And I know you don't have a headshot, but you need to get him one. And black and whites aren't popular anymore. You got to get a color one. And if you can't afford it, just come over to my house. I have a backdrop. I'll take a good shot of you. And you need a demo video. And the video, you just get yourself a sword basket, a sub trunk, maybe a zombie ball. And I know you don't have an assistant or a show or anything trained, but you love magic, and you've loved magic forever. And we'll get you a girl, and she's already trained, and I have the illusions in my garage, and we'll just film it in the garage and get it done real quick. And you send him a short little bio. We just talk about the place you performed and that you love magic and how much you love magic. And we'll send it off to him, and then he'll start booking you right away. And they say, really? And I say, no. He doesn't exist. That guy does not exist, and that is not how it works. But that's how the movies teach us.
Yeah.
That's how everybody tells us. That's how our drama teacher tells us it works. It does not work that way.
Yeah.
The way it works is you have to find a target audience, build a show that fulfills their needs, and sell it to them.
Wasn't it Lana Turner who supposedly was found in the soda shop there
in
Hollywood and Vine? And yeah, those stories don't happen very often, and that probably is a Hollywood story too, or legend. But you're exactly right. It's like any other job. To the road to success is practice and hard work.
Yeah.
And they talk about show business being, two-thirds business and one-third show.
Right.
It's really a lot more than that. So you have to keep after it.
I spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, selling my product.
Yeah.
And I spend time on the weekends and time after those 8 hours a day working on my hobby.
Mm-hmm. One last thing, because it's called the magic word. You and I have shared time together and microphones together as we have covered some other conventions and worked with the Magic Newswire and some other things, even for the magic word here. And you may have answered this question in the past, but what is your magic word? It might be a credo, a lifestyle, what you live by, not necessarily just abracadabra. It may be something that you use in your show, but something that you would...
Just one word?
Or a phrase. It could be just
two
words.
I'm going to give you a quote. I'm going to give you a quote that I often close my 90-minute show with.
Okay.
There is an infinitude in the private man. If a single man plants himself indomitably upon his instincts and there abides, the huge world will come round to him. This is Ralph Waldo Emerson. What does it mean? There's an infinitude. Everything is in the private man. Not the public man, the politician, the celebrity, or the millionaire, the private man, us, individuals. There's an infinitude in the private man. If a single man or woman plants themselves indomitably, stands forever upon their instincts, what they know to be true and good and right, and there abides, eventually the world will come round to them, because truth is within each of us. That's my credo.
So boiling that down to a word would be truth.
I like
that's a lot of bullying.
I like Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss.
Follow your bliss. I would say follow tomatoes if it was Joseph Campbell. Tomato soup. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, Paul. This has been just a wonderful interview, and I appreciate your insight, and we could talk on any subject, and I know that our listeners certainly would enjoy hearing whatever you have to say.
Have them check out my website at paulwdraper.com, www.paulwdraper.com.
That's great. Thank you very much. And so for now, for the Magic Word, this is Scotty out.